Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Bill Hartung of the World Policy Institute, who assesses the risk of nuclear war between India and Pakistan as tensions rise over the disputed territory of Kashmir. Jennifer Harbury, a U.S. attorney and widow of the murdered Mayan guerrilla leader Efrain Bamaca Velasquez, who talks about the recent increase in violence and human rights abuses in Guatemala. And Terry O'Neill of the National Organization for Women, who discusses the Bush administration's drive to include strict work rules in a bill reauthorizing the 1996 Welfare Reform Act. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On the afternoon of April the 19th, 16-year-old Milwaukee peace activist Alia Kate went to the airport to take a flight to the big April the 20th peace demonstration in Washington, D.C. But Kate and 20 other activists from Peace Action Milwaukee were detained at the airport gate by security officers, and the group missed their flight. According to the Progressive magazine, the activists were stopped and questioned because several names popped up on the no-fly watch list, maintained by the U.S. government's Transportation Security Administration that is now in charge of airport security. Catholic nun Virginia Loinger, an activist on Columbia issues, was also detained. She told the Progressive magazine, "Our names were flagged. I felt it was the profiling of a particular group, a peace group. The abuse of power is so obvious." Kate compared her treatment by security officers to McCarthy-style tactics, in the way that the names of political dissidents are collected on government watch lists. Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich denounced the security dragnet. He warned that databases are being organized, including the names of totally innocent people who are being questioned on the basis of political views. In a democracy, he said, that is not acceptable. The news magazine In These Times reports that clean election reform has become bogged down in liberal Massachusetts. That is where House Speaker Thomas Finneran, an old-style Democrat, has halted public funds from financing upcoming state elections, a reform measure approved by voters in 1998 by a 2-to-1 margin. For months, Finneran's defiance of campaign reform has created a full-blown state constitutional crisis. In 1999, the state legislature set aside $20 million for clean election candidates running in 2002. But Finneran, a career politician, has refused to increase the funding and has refused to release any of the collected funds earmarked for campaigning in this fall's election. Now, reformers, with the aid of the state's Republican and Green parties, have gone to state court to win control of the clean election money. The court awarded the reformers the power to seize state property and sell it to raise funds for clean election campaigns. The reformers have already seized 4 state cars and office furniture from Finneran and his allies. 30 candidates are all hoping to run with public financing in Massachusetts this year. Elsewhere, in Maine, Vermont, and Arizona, publicly funded clean elections are moving forward, with more women and minority candidates running for legislative seats. Moreover, they are spending more time on grassroots campaigning rather than on fundraising. Extra, the magazine of FAIR, the media watch group, describes how right-wing media attempted to discredit the U.S. Forest Service. The Wall Street Journal stated, inaccurately, that the Fish and Wildlife Service had planted lynx hares in states where there were no lynx, so that the sites could be labeled critical habitat and off-limits to humans. The Washington Times, owned by the Reverend Moon's Unification Church, produced 13 articles on this alleged biofraud or lynxgate. Actually, the biologists provided in control samples hair from captive lynx to check the lab's ability to recognize it. Moreover, the Endangered Species Act has no power to shut down forests. Conservative lawmakers, property rights organizations, and extractive industries see the Endangered Species Act as putting creatures before jobs. Republican congressmen amplify the flawed Washington Times coverage, denouncing the claimed biofraud as scandalous and repeating the inaccuracies. The whole thing was later picked up by the Washington Post, Associated Press, Rocky Mountain News, and again the Wall Street Journal. The Seattle Times and Outside magazine accurately deconstructed the story, showing that the institution shown to be least trustworthy by Lynxgate is the U.S. Press. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Rees.
Dollars mast mast chuletan kalandar 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 mast mast chuletan
Nearly a million soldiers from India and Pakistan have massed on the border of the disputed territory of Jammu and Kashmir, raising tensions between the two nuclear powers for the second time in 6 months. The latest incident, which sparked new fears of war, occurred on May 14th, when three Islamic militants infiltrated the Indian-held sector of Kashmir and killed 30 people, many of whom were the wives and children of Indian troops. This clash and a string of attacks, including a December attack on the Indian Parliament, have led the nationalist government of Prime Minister Vajpayee to threaten a military response unless Pakistani leader General Musharraf halts all cross-border terrorist incursions into India. Alarm at the prospect of nuclear war between these two South Asian rivals has triggered a round of diplomatic activity by the U.S., Britain and Russia in an 11th-hour effort to reduce the prospect of a border conflict that could easily spin out of control. U.S. military planners estimate that if India and Pakistan were to engage in nuclear war, 3 to 12 million people would be killed. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bill Hartung of the World Policy Institute, who assesses the danger of war between India and Pakistan, fallout from America's war on terrorism, and the negative role U.S. nuclear weapons doctrine plays in influencing how other nuclear powers wield their weapons of mass destruction.
Well, this is the second time that they've had a conflict over Kashmir since their nuclear tests in 1998. The last time in 1999, some Pakistani-supported forces went into a mountainous area across the line of control, the disputed border of Kashmir, and India responded with aircraft and artillery and basically drove them out of there. But during that war, we are now told that there were at least six different times when one or the other side threatened to use nuclear weapons. And in fact, when the Pakistani president was in the United States, he was informed by President Clinton that his armed forces had armed some of their ballistic missiles with nuclear weapons, something which the president of Pakistan had not authorized and was surprised to learn. So I think there's danger partly because of the, you know, this conflict really goes back to the partition that separated India and Pakistan back in the 1940s. And in both countries, there's strong nationalist desires to control the entirety of that territory. And in recent years, Pakistan has stepped up its support for Kashmiri forces who've been trying to use various attacks on civilians and Indian-supported institutions to win, not independence, but basically get the portion controlled by India back in Pakistani control. So I think because of the depth of the conflict, the fact that you've got countries that are kind of new at this awful game of nuclear deterrence that don't necessarily have clear lines of communication. They have nothing like a hotline like was developed during the Cold War. They've also got the issue that since they're bordering countries, nuclear missile launched with a nuclear weapon on it could take 6 to 8 minutes to reach its target. So there's very little time for either side to decide, am I being attacked by a conventional weapon, a nuclear weapon? And of course, neither side has really, during this current conflict, renounced the possibility of using nuclear weapons. I think for all those reasons, it's a very dangerous situation. I think about the most dangerous kind of situation you can imagine involving nuclear weapons, since you've got these bordering countries with this longstanding conflict. So there's not a lot of time to let cooler heads prevail if things start escalating.
What are some of the miscalculations that you fear could be made that could lead to the start of a nuclear conflict there?
Well, one thing that's happening on the Indian side is the Indian government has been downplaying the relevance and power of the Pakistani nuclear arsenal, saying it's not really to be feared all that much, and that, you know, that they should be able to prosecute what they describe as a limited war against Pakistan without facing nuclear retaliation. And then on the Pakistani side, I think the Musharraf government is in a difficult position because over this last less than a year since he became part of the U.S.-led coalition fighting the war in Afghanistan, he has had to buck public opinion in his own country to a considerable degree. There was strong support for Taliban in Pakistan. Pakistani intelligence helped set up the Taliban government, was very supportive of them. Also, Pakistani intelligence had helped to arm and train some of the groups that have been going into Kashmir and causing some of these disturbances and bombings and so forth. So both sides have allowed the nationalism to run fairly free as a way to garner support.
In your view, has the U.S. stepped up to its role as the world's remaining superpower to try and intervene here and intercede to make sure this doesn't develop into a full-blown conflict or a nuclear conflict?
I think they've been slow to deal with this. There were concerns raised even, you know, in the wake of September 11th when the United States developed this lines of convenience with the Musharraf regime to fight the war in Afghanistan, that there were going to be serious problems in the India-Pakistan relationship that would flow from that. And so it seems like they're kind of focused on the war on terrorism, and as they see it, building alliances for that purpose has kind of blinded them to that there are other important priorities in the world. And likewise, on the nuclear front, the United States released a new nuclear posture this spring, which reserved the right to use or threaten to use nuclear weapons, which mentioned six or seven target countries against which they might be used, including countries that didn't have nuclear weapons. And they talked about developing low-yield systems that could be used to hit underground bunkers. So likewise, on that score, to tell Pakistan, you know, you shouldn't be brandishing and threatening to use nuclear weapons when the United States is basically doing that in its own policy and, of course, has a much larger nuclear arsenal. There's sort of no moral basis to argue this. It becomes sort of just power politics. You know, do it because we say you should do it, and there'll be consequences if you don't listen to us. So I think for all those reasons, the sort of focus on terrorism as the enemy, the right of retaliation against nations that harbor terrorists, the notion that threatening to use nuclear weapons is an acceptable practice for the world's sole remaining superpower. I think all those things have contributed to this current difficult situation that we have in South Asia.
That was Bill Hartung of the World Policy Institute. Contact the Institute by calling area code 212-229-5808 or visit their website at www.worldpolicy.org. In May 2000, charges were filed in two important human rights cases in Guatemala, one regarding the murder of Bishop Juan Girardi and the other concerning massacres under the government of General Romeo Lucas Garcia. Since then, abuses against Guatemalan human rights activists and others either reporting on or involved in anti-impunity initiatives have risen sharply. Activists have received death threats, beatings, and some have disappeared. The offices of several organizations have been broken into, with files and computers related to the cases being stolen, altered, or destroyed. The Guatemalan authorities have been ineffective in investigating or preventing these abuses. Barbara Bosek is a U.S. citizen and specialist on Guatemala for Amnesty International. On June 11, 2001, while on a delegation in Guatemala City, Bosek was assaulted and abducted from her hotel room. On March 10th of this year, near Forks, Washington State, she was thrown on the ground, bound and gagged by two unidentified men who threatened her in Spanish before leaving her locked in her car. And on May 1st, shortly after an op-ed piece she had written appeared in the Baltimore Sun, Bosek received the first in a series of anonymous death threats by telephone. Jennifer Harbury is a U.S. citizen and attorney. She is also the widow of the murdered Mayan guerrilla fighter Efrain Bamaca Velasquez, who was captured in 1993 by the Guatemalan military and murdered. Jennifer Harbury spoke with your reporter Denise Manzari about the recent increase of violence and human rights abuses in Guatemala.
The peace accords were signed, of course, in December of 1996, and part of those peace accords was a specific provision or agreement that from then on the government would comply with all international and domestic law for human rights and civil rights. And unfortunately, they obviously thought that that was just a piece of paper they were signing and that there would be no pressure upon them to comply. And in fact, there has not been. And we have a sweep of violence now going through Guatemala, the United Nations. contact person has reported 150 human rights leaders have been either threatened, attacked, or murdered outright in Guatemala during the last year alone. And, you know, leading example is Rigoberta Menchú's chief staffer in her Guatemala City office, who literally a few weeks ago walked across the street for lunch and was shot through the head. Someone had anonymously been calling into the office all morning long, playing funeral dirges over the phone and then hanging up. Things are very, very critical, and it's because the Army and the death squads know that right now the United States government and Congress are busy thinking about other things and will not cut short their military fundings, and that they can act with full impunity, and so they're doing it.
G2 forces, are they still an active force in Guatemala?
They're still very much active, and a lot of their members are, in fact, in high-level positions in the government at this time. The head of the Congress, of course, is Rios Montt, who was president during the worst of the massacre campaigns in the 80s, which have been ruled de facto genocide by the United Nations Truth Commission report.
The Guatemalan authorities and other representatives, I think, in the United States have questioned Barbara Brosek on the legitimacy of someone delivering death threats in the United States long distance from Guatemala.
Well, I cannot imagine why these people are taking such a foolish position. I mean, if they can send people up here to shoot at us, they can most certainly, when they're in this country anyway, working hand in glove with the CIA, as we know they do. The fact is they come up here all the time and work very closely with the CIA, and the FBI and other law enforcement agencies are supposed to keep a hands-off position because they're not supposed to be meddling with CIA contacts. And all of this is supposed to be the great, great secret because it's embarrassing to our intelligence sources. But if we're going to be in bed with death squad people, then we have to take responsibility for what they do. And we need to protect American citizens and American residents from the harm that can come from these people. They are extremely dangerous.
Also, the case of Fred Pecorelli, who's the president of the Guatemalan Anthropological Forensics Foundation, has had to leave the country as well.
As has a journalist who was covering the mass exhumations and was acting as a liaison, I believe, for NPR, in fact, and had come back to the capital and was literally dragged off the streets in broad daylight and kidnapped, and was, I think someone held a gun to his head. It was four heavily armed men who said they were taking him away to kill him, but first they wanted all of his materials. And he simply leaped out of the car and ran to safety at one point, although I'm sure, you know, that it was quite a rough tumble as he got out of the car, and he was so frightened he went into exile immediately.
Just very briefly, can you give us an update of what is going on in your case regarding your murdered husband, Efrain Velasquez?
Well, there's two branches of that case. We won an international lawsuit out of the Inter-American Court in San Jose, Costa Rica. That's similar to the World Court, only it's for this hemisphere, and it's a human rights court. And we were very, very pleased with that. That's a civil rights case similar to police brutality, and it was more than 100 pages and unanimous in our favor against the Guatemalan military. And they've also just issued a fairly major ruling on reparations that the Army will have to give us, including a fairly novel ruling that they must give me back his body within the next 6 months. So I'm very pleased with that.
There are many threats and attacks against human rights workers and activists. What measures can they take while they're in Guatemala to protect themselves from these kinds of
attacks? They have no protection. They must depend on people like us in this country calling incessantly to Congress and to the Guatemalan embassy, going down there to accompany them, you know, working out vigils for them, calling constantly to different public leaders in Guatemala and working with our own government officials to work out sanctions for Guatemalan officials who do not comply with the peace accords. If there are no consequences for murder, then the killers continue to kill. That's exactly what is happening right now.
Do you think this increase in human rights violations and violence against citizens of Guatemala is linked to U.S. interests in Latin America?
Absolutely. It always has been. The army in Guatemala, this very military that was found by the United Nations to be guilty of genocide and a campaign of terror that lasted for 35 years, this is the army that the United States put in power through a violent coup against a legally and popularly elected president in 1954. We didn't like his socioeconomic policies, and we saw fit to put Guatemala on the track we wanted them to be on. The price was 200,000 human lives lost to the death squads.
That was Jennifer Harbury, U.S. citizen, attorney, and widow of Mayan guerrilla fighter Efrain Bamaca Velasquez. Harbury has yet to locate her husband's remains and has filed a civil lawsuit against the CIA. For more information, call the Guatemalan Human Rights Commission at area code 202-529-6599 or visit their website at www.ghrc-usa.org. It's been 6 years since Congress passed controversial welfare reform legislation. Since President Clinton signed the bill into law, Beltway pundits and politicians have celebrated welfare reform as a major success. But these observers often limit their examination solely to the decrease in numbers of welfare recipients, ignoring the dire conditions of poverty in which many former recipients are now forced to live. As Congress debates reauthorization of welfare reform, the Bush administration succeeded in convincing the Republican-controlled House of Representatives to include new strict work rules in a bill passed there on May 16th. The legislation requires poor mothers receiving welfare to work 40 hours a week without providing adequate funding for child care, but does allocate millions of dollars for dubious programs promoting marriage. Under the House bill, time spent by welfare recipients in education or training will not be counted toward the 40-hour requirement. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Terry O'Neill, the National Organization for Women's Membership Vice President, who discusses the battle over welfare reform, which now moves to the U.S. Senate.
The House passed essentially the Bush administration's bill. And the Bush administration on welfare reauthorization had basically two ideas. First of all, they want poor parents to work harder, and second, they want them to get married. So it's work harder, get married. And then the Bush administration said, and by the way, we want you to work more hours and get married, and we will not provide you child care protection. We will not provide you with an education so that you can get a good job that pays a living wage where you can support your family, and we will not provide you with other of the essential work supports like housing, transportation, health insurance, and so forth. So the Bush administration's proposal simply continues the punitive nature of welfare reform, which is what we have always taken the position that the 1996 law was.
Maybe you could speak to some of the debates back and forth about the strict work requirements contained in the House bill and the arguments made on the Republican side to withhold funding for training and child care and the other essentials that seem to be critical to making the transition from government aid and assistance to full-time employment.
Well, yeah, as I understand it, the Republicans take the position that, first of all, they don't want poor mothers to get an education. Tommy Thompson said in Wisconsin that, in his view, welfare should not be, quote, a college scholarship program for poor people. He derided that. He derided the very idea that if you're poor, you somehow need to have an education so that you can support your family. Wade Horn, who is currently the Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services, who is responsible for administering the Welfare Act, repeated that very recently, just a couple of months ago, said he had no intention of allowing welfare to engage in actually educating people who are poor. The Republicans' attitude then is no education for poor people. What this is really about is poor women, and what poor women really need to do is to get married so that they become financially dependent on a man, and it will then be that man's problem to support them and instead of the government.
We see a similar attitude in many of the evangelical and right-wing church organizations, like with Jerry Falwell and others. Has this been influenced, in your view, by them and the Bush administration's agenda here?
Well, certainly Wade Horn, Tommy Thompson, John Ashcroft are themselves the products of far right-wing Christian evangelical political thinking. There's no doubt about that. And in addition, their program, which says to poor women, you just need to be under the control of men, is part of that whole political agenda. I think there's no doubt about it. Yeah.
What is ahead in the U.S. Senate as far as welfare reform legislation, where the bills move next, and what can people do to influence that legislation?
Well, the Senate Finance Committee is going to be considering welfare reform legislation, and there are a number of bills that are popping around that the committee will, we believe, be considering. One of those bills has been put forward by a group of Democrats. Another bill has been put forward by a group that calls itself Democrat, but it turns out to be the Republican bill. Senators Bayh and Carper, who in fact are Democrats, put forth a bill that looks almost exactly like the Bush administration bill. It's just appalling. And what people can do is contact your senator post haste and tell your senator not to support the Bayh-Carper proposal. It's horrendous. Sure, it throws a few more dollars at education and a few more little dollars at child care, but it is basically the Bush administration's proposal. We're hoping that that people will also call their senators and urge them to sign on to the letter drafted by Senator Ted Kennedy, who is the chair of the so-called HELP Committee, Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, which doesn't have jurisdiction over the welfare bill, but Senator Kennedy and 18 other senators have signed on to this letter laying out a series of principles that should guide the welfare debate in the Senate, those principles being education for poor people, work supports like child care and adequate health care funding and housing and transportation. And we're hoping that the Senate will come up with a bill that is not punitive with respect to poor families and, in fact, sets up a structure within which welfare can really begin achieving its goal, moving people out of poverty and into self-sufficiency.
That was Terry O'Neill of the National Organization for Women. Contact now by calling area code 202-628-8669. Or visit their website at www.now.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Nigel Reese, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.